Okay, we're beginning here with the Mishnah on Lamed Amun Aleph. The Mishnah says, "Hamalve ma'ot et ha-kohen v'et ha-levi v'et ha-ani, v'ot mafrish alehem michelkan." If a person lends money to a kohen, to a levi, or to ani, on the condition that the repayment schedule will be made from the matanot that are usually collected by the kohen, the levi, or the ani, from the produce of this balabait, mafrish alehen b'chazkat shehen kayamin. Person can be mafrish from his crops on their behalf with the chazakah or the assumption that they are still alive. Veinu chushesh shema meta kohen o alevi o hishir he'ani. And you don't have to worry about the fact that the kohen possibly passed away or that the levi passed away or the fact that the ani became wealthy. So similar to our previous Mishnah that spoke about this with regards to Gitin, that we make an assumption that the individual is still alive when he creates agency to send the individual to give the get. Similarly over here, in this loan setup, the Mishnah tells us that you can assume if such a agreement was made between the parties, that you can assume that the Kohen or the Levi or the Ani with whom this loan arrangement was made is still alive. May do, but if we find out that they actually have passed away, tzarich litol rishut min hayoshim, then the individual has to ask permission from the inheritors to continue this program that he has set up with their parent or the individual with whom he had the agreement originally. Because as Rashi says over here, shein chov zeh mutal alehem lifroa, there's no obligation on the yoshim to repay the loans of the father or the loans of the individuals who granted them the Yerusha. And therefore, according to Rashi, he has to ask permission from these inheritors in order to continue this payment plan, which they are not obligated to undertake. On the other hand, the Rambam in the Perush HaMishnayot says that the reason he has to ask permission from the Yorshim is because this is a case where the Yorshim inherited land from the Morish, and that individual then with or along with that Yerusha is also inheriting the obligation to pay or continue to abuse this payment plan that was set up because there's an encumbrance on the party to repay the loan because of the karka or the land that they inherited. But the reason we have to ask the Yerushim is that they might prefer a different payment plan. They might prefer to pay off the loan completely from different means or a different source, and thereby collect the matanot going forward. And so the question here is not about whether they will repay it, but the method that by which they will repay it. And that's why you have to get permission from the Yorshim. This goes to a machloket on the Amud Bet as to the nature of the Mishnah here in this case and the following case as to whether the Yorshim actually inherited karka or not. Here you can see that the Rambam in his explanation assumes that the Yorshim did get karka, and therefore, the Netilat Rishut is not about the obligation to repay, but the method of repayment. Hilvan Bifnei Beit Din. On the other hand, if he did this whole loan structure in front of Beit Din, Enu Tzarich Litol Rishut Min HaYorshim, then he does not have to get permission from the Yorshim. As Rashi says over here, the Yesh Koach the Beit Din Ahatil Chov Zeh Al Kol HaKuhuna VeAlviyah, that Beit Din has the right to impose this obligation on the Shevet in general, the Fisha Takanatan, who? Because it's to their benefit, Sheimtzu Ma'ot Lahalva'a, that they'll be ready available monies for borrowing. And that's why we have this Takana, that if it's done in front of Beit Din, then it supersedes the normal rules of Yerusha and obligations, and we impose this obligation on the Shevet as a whole to repay this, in order that there be a liquid market for loans to Kohanim and Leviim. And so therefore, if he does it in Beit Din has that right to, I guess, invoke the principle of Hefker, Beit Din Hefker, and obligate the parties being now Shevet Kuna and Shevet Levi, to repay this individual the money that he had lent to this particular Kohen or Levi. And even though Rashi only here specifies the Kohen and Levi, it seemingly would have equal application to the Ani, but we'll see some nuances about the Ani further on the Amud. And again here, the question of whether the Yoresh has to inherit Karka from this individual for this to be true or not will be subject to the Machloket that we mentioned before on the Amud Bet. Now the Gemara asks, How is it possible this individual who came up with this scheme to have the individuals pay him through the matanot can go ahead then and, in a sense, take the matanot that he is being mafrish without ever reaching the hands of the Kohen, the Levi, and the Ani? Because there is a mitzvah of nitina, of giving such hafrashot, the chuma, the maaser rishon, the chumat maaser, and the maaser ani, to the individuals who are the appropriate recipients. And then once he's given to them, if they so choose to give it back to him, that is fine. Now, in the case of maaser rishon and maaser ani, the individual could eat them themselves because they are chulin, with the exception in maaser rishon of the chumat maaser, which must be separated or segregated out and given to the Kohen. On the other hand, with the chumat gedolah, the Kohen is the only one who can eat it. Therefore, if he withholds the chumat gedolah for the benefit of his loan, he can't eat it, but he can sell it as chumat and use the proceeds from that sale to repay the loan. But in any of these instances, it seems from our Mishnah that he just keeps the matanot without ever reaching the hands of the recipient. And how does that work? How are we not having the mitzvah of netina be done properly over here? So I'm a Rav, b'makirei kuna b'livia. Rav says that this is an instance where this individual has a particular Kohen, Levi, and seemingly it would be the same would be true by an Ani, who he gives the matanot to on a regular basis. And so because of that, there's almost an automatic kinyan by the individual, because all the other Kohanim, Leviim, or Aniim have been mityaish. They've given up hope of ever getting those matanot, because they know this individual always gives it to this particular Kohen, Levi, or Ani. And because of that, there is a muta de pshita, as Rashi says, because everyone else has given up hope of getting it, and it always goes to these individuals, it's as if it reached them. And therefore, a way to solve this problem is to say that it actually is as if it reached their hand, since they are the natural recipients of these items. Then automatically, once you are mafrishit from the produce, it is theirs. And they almost have an automatic kinyan on it because of that. And therefore, it reached their hands, and now he's just taking it back from them. Ushmol amar b'mizakelehem ayidei acherim. He uses a third party to acquire it on their behalf. The balabait finds someone who is willing to accept on behalf of the Kohen, the Levi, or the Ani, the matanot. And because he was mizakeh to them, then he can take it back, because in a sense it reached their hands by this third party taking possession of it on their behalf. Ulamar hamani Rabbi Yosihi. Ula says that the author of our Mishnah is Rabbi Yosi. Damar asuach eno zocheh kezocheh. That the Chachamim instituted takanot in numerous occasions, which, as Rashi notes, examples of this shita of Rabbi Yosi, for instance, an ani, who is shaking the tree or knocking down produce from the tree, and then it falls below. So even though he technically hasn't taken possession of it, nevertheless, we assume he's taking possession of it because it's the benefit of all aniim who are collecting in such a manner. If we didn't do that, and any ani who went up to shake the tree and make the fruits down, someone else could wait below and take it. Now, in that instance, it might be to his benefit, but the next time it happens, it'll be to his detriment. And so they establish certain protocols of acquisition, even though they don't have a formal kinyan, including putting out traps where animals are trapped in them, that they belong to the owner of the trap, or the mitziah v'cheresh shoteh v'katan, that it belongs to them, even though technically they don't have the ability to make acquisitions, so on and so forth. There are other instances where Rabbi Yossi, you can see in Rashi, indicates that such takanot were put in place to the benefit of society at large. Because of takanot that were to the benefit of the parties, they made it as if this individual already accepted and got possession of it, even though they really did not get possession of it. It was an act of beit din, a takanat beit din, for the benefit of all the parties involved. So now the Gemara says, Kulu karav lo amre. Not everyone suggested like Rav did, because b'makirei lo ktoni. The word makirei never appears in our Mishnah, and therefore that's a qualification of the Mishnah that is not explicit in the Mishnah, and therefore they do not accept Rav's ukimta in the Mishnah. Because Shmuel lo kamre. They don't explain the Mishnah like Shmuel. B'mezakeh lo ktani. It never says in the Mishnah that there's a third party here that is taking it on behalf of the recipients. Now, as Tosafot points out over here, both Rav and Shmuel have the same problem, which is the absence of a qualifying word in the Mishnah that tells you what the Mishnah is speaking about. So therefore, why did one pick their position over the other position? And Tosafot says, with regards to Shmuel, it says, Mekom akom nechle lukmei mizakeh, dari b'chol kohanim. Because at least with mizakeh, then the Mishnah can be explained about any kohen, or any Levi, or any ani, not a specific or particular ani, kohen, or Levi. Whereas Rav favored his explanation, because the Mishnah here talks about no kinyan whatsoever. So better to talk about a narrower set of kohanim, levim, or aniim, but not have to have any kinyan or formal kinyan that takes place, because that is absent in the Mishnah. That's why Rav or Shmuel favors their position, despite the fact that neither of them are mentioned in the Mishnah. Ke'ulo nami lo amri, Rav and Shmuel did not agree to Ula's position, ke'yechida lo mukminan. They don't want to set it up like a dat yachid, like Rabbi Yossi. As Tosa points out, afagav de Shmuel pasak ke Rabbi Yossi. Even though Shmuel himself is posek Rabbi Yossi, he still wanted to establish our Mishnah kol ha-deot, and not just limit the Mishnah to the sheet of Rabbi Yossi, despite the fact that he does paskin like Rabbi Yossi. Other Rishonim say just because Shmuel paskins like Rabbi Yossi with regards to one of these takanot, doesn't mean that Shmuel thinks like Rabbi Yossi in all of these takanot that he established. Tanra Banan. Hamavema ot et ha-kohen v'et ha-levi v'et ha-ani. And the Tosefted says that a person who lends money to the kohen, the levi, or the ani, deot mafrish alehem mechelkan, with the assumption that the payment plan will be through his receipt of the matanot that will come off of his tevuah. Mafrish alehem v'chaskat shein kayamim, like our Mishnah says, he can be mafrish with the assumption that they are still alive. And he can contract with them that the payment will be done at the market price that is lower. And there is no interest that is caused by this. And shvi'it does not cause the loan to be forgiven like other shmitat ksafim. And if he wants to back out of it, he may not back out of it. It's Yahshua Balim. If the Balim give up hope of getting matanot out of this field in a given year, ein mafrishin alehem, lefishein mafrishin ala avud, then he cannot take it when it comes to the harvest of that year. You cannot keep the matanot because you cannot separate out matanot on your behalf when you thought it was all lost. So now the Gemara is going to go through the Tosefta and explain each one of those items. Amar posekim mehem kishar hazol. He can set up the agreement that he gets back, or when he takes the matanot, that it's done at the lower price. So as Rashi explains over here, when they come to this agreement, it's not necessarily during the harvest time, when at that time the produce is more expensive. In their day, they did not have refrigeration, they didn't have means of storing it for long duration, and therefore during the periods of time when it wasn't the harvest season, food in general and the produce in general was more expensive. When it came to the harvest time and there was plenty available, then the price would go down. So the individual can set up this agreement at a period of time where the price of produce at that time is higher, but agreement that when he receives the matanot, that he will charge that price as the price of the going rate in the market at the time that it comes to the separation of the matanot, which all likelihood will be in the harvest time, where the price will be much cheaper. So effectively, he is charging them interest for the lending of the money. He is providing them cash today, and if he were to take that cash and buy produce today, he would get a smaller amount of produce. So now, by lending it to this individual, and then accepting repayment during the harvest season where the cost of produce is much lower, in the end, he will end up with much more produce than had he bought it today. So in essence, he is taking, we'll call it profit, from the fact that he is giving them money today, providing them liquidity today, and taking repayment later on. He gets more than he could have bought today, or technically that is being lent to them. And so effectively, there's interest being charged on this amount. And so what the Tosefta says that posekim hem kishar azol. Gemara says here, pshita, why can't he do that? Because anybody can do that, because there's a readily available market price for the tevuah, and then the individual themselves can go ahead and use the same monies that were lent to them to purchase that tevuah, and they will lose nothing. There is no really effective rebate being charged in repaying at that time of the harvest, bishat shar hazol, because that was the stipulated agreement up front. And so why should it be different here with the kohen than it would be with any other individual? Gemara says, hakamashmalin, avo pish lo pasak, kamish pasak dami. That even though they did not explicitly make this agreement, it's implied in the loan that that will be the agreement. Since the repayment will come out of the matanot, by definition, it will be at a time when the price is cheaper, and therefore it's assumed here that that will be the set market price at the time that he takes the matanot, and that will be the price that he assigns to the repayment of the loan based on the produce that comes out of the field. Bein bo mishum ribit, my taima, why is there no interest over here? Kevin dechilele, lo yoivle, kiitlehe, nami, ein bo mishum ribit. The reason being is because if the field produces nothing, this individual will get no money. If the field produces something, he will get the money. So that is not interest. Interest is something that comes definitively, which is no matter what, this individual will not lose because he will get a repayment of his loan, plus he will get an excess of that. In this case, that's not true because there's a possibility that he gave money and then in this year he won't receive payment of the loan at all because of the fact that there's no produce that came out. It was a year of famine, it was a year of drought, and he gets nothing at all. So there's no certainty to his repayment. Therefore, when he gets kishar hazol, it's also not considered to be rebate, because this isn't something where he definitively will get more money, because there could be a postponement of the repayment, and then this individual will be out the money for a longer period of time, or even possibly, he will never get repayment, because this individual passes away, goes to the Yorshim. So the fact that there's uncertainty in the repayment makes it that this is not deemed to be rebate. And again, even though maybe in general we would not allow such a setup or loan setup because it doesn't look right or it's not proper, as Tosfot points out over here, Hecha Yitiru Mishum Takanat Kohen. Over here they allowed such a setup because it's not real rebate. And if you say it's for Maratayin or there is a semblance of rebate over here, Chamim waived it in this instance in order to provide liquidity or the availability of funds for the Kohanim, the Levim, and the Aniim. Now Rashi over here seems to indicate that the Tosefta statement of Posekimo Kishar Azol Ve'imbo Mishum Ribit is really one item. The Shar Azol is not a problem of Ribit. There are other Rishonim who see this as being two different issues, which is number one is Posekimo Kishar Azol. He's allowed to establish the pricing based on the market price that will come at the time of the harvest. And then a second statement by the Gemara of Imbo Mishum Ribit, which indicates that even if he is posek at an amount far below that price, then he is still allowed to do such. And you can see that in the Tosafot who says, Posekimo Kishar Azol, Kinvifareish, Davagav Dolo Pasak, Navish Pasak Dami. Imbo Mishum Ribit, Afilo Posek Harbe Pachot Mishar Azol. Even if he sets the price way below the market price at the time of the harvest, that is still allowed, and it's not rebate for the reasons that we explained before. There's not certainty of repayment, and therefore it is not considered or deemed to be rebate. So for them, there are actually two statements here. The first of which is that they can set the pricing based on the lower price that will be prevalent at the time of the harvest. As Rashi says over here, he can basically set it up that at the lower of the two prices of the price today, or the price of the Shar Azol, that's embedded in such an agreement, or repayment agreement that we have here. And then secondarily, as Tosfos points out, Ein Bo Mishum Ribit, even if they set the price way below what the market price will be at the time of the harvest, there isn't Ribit for the reasons that we just stated. Bein Shvi'it Mishamto, and Shvi'it does not wipe out the loan because of Shemitah Ksafim, the Lo Kirinim Bei Lo Igos. Because over there, there's no pressure being applied to the lovet, to the debtor, in order to repay the loan. Since the payment plan is set out in advance, whereby which the balabait will get whatever matanot come out, and it can't go back to the debtor to force repayment, and it can't demand that he repay faster, so because of that, there's no lo igos. Shmitat Ksafim is a protection that the individual may not go and pressure the debtor to come and pay him. But over here, where there is no pressuring of the debtor, there is also no Shmitat Ksafim that is associated with it. The same way that the Prusbol works by turning over one's loans to the Beit Din, where the individual can no longer pressure the debtor for repayment, since the Beit Din will be the ones who execute or demand the repayment, and that's not subject to Loi Gos. If it's not subject to Loi Gos, it's also not subject to Shmitat Ksafim. If he wants to back out of this agreement that they made, he may not do so. That is only true in one of the two directions. That is that the balabait who lent the money can't back out of it with regards to the kohen. On the other hand, if the kohen wants to back out of this agreement with the balabait, he can back out of it. It's not because we have a Mishnah. If he gives money to buy something, but he does not make a kinyan on the payroll, he is able to back out of it because there was no consummation of the deal with regards to the acquisition of this item. And so Rashi says similarly over here, when the balabait hands over the money, that locks him into the agreement because at that time, the kohen had no obligation to make a kinyan on metalkalim or any other object because there was no other object there. And therefore, the mere fact that he took the money and accepted the money locks the balabait into this position. On the other hand, as Rashi says, the kohen can back out of it because he who granted the balabait the peirot, but the balabait has yet to make a kinyan on those peirot, that kinyan is absent here. Because of the absence of that kinyan, he can say to the balabait, you never made a kinyan. And since you never made a kinyan, I have no obligation to stay in this agreement. I can back out of this agreement. So because of the nature of this transaction, whereby part of it is immediate and part of it's in the future, the part that's immediate is the granting of the money of the balabait to the kohen. That is sealed, and the balabait can't back out of it. On the other hand, for the kohen, the payment plan is a methodology by which the kinyan will only happen in the future. And therefore, he has the ability to back out of the agreement. Obviously, if he backs out, he has to repay the loan, but he can back out of this payment plan that they had agreed upon. And again, the reason being over here, because all of this is done for the benefit of the kohen and the levi, as we've seen in the Mishnah, and we'll see again, that the reason we allow such a payment plan to be put in place is to provide liquidity in the market for these individuals. And if they so choose that they don't want to use or utilize this methodology, they have a right to back out of it. And since it's to their benefit, it's also one-sided in locking in this type of deal where the balabait or the lender is locked in, whereas the debtor is not locked in to this type of payment plan. And as Tosafot points out, that even though this is the sheet of Rabbi Shimon and the Gemara of Rabbi Mitzia, here the Chachamim would agree to the sheet of Rabbi Shimon that the one holding the money has the upper hand because over here there is nothing to make a kinyan on in terms of the payroll, and therefore even the Chachamim would agree to the shita of Rabbi Shimon in this instance. Now based on that, once the payment plan begins and the Baal Debait is mezakeh, the payroll, to the Kohen, Levi, or Ani over here, then maybe according to this you would not be able to back out of it anymore because then there is a kinyan here which then solidifies or locks in the payment plan that was agreed upon between the two parties. Others suggest that what we just said before about the rebate is actually the reason for this, which is that there's no certainty of repayment over here. There's a possibility that the loan will not be repaid. And because there's no certainty of repayment, there's a certain aspect of matana that is associated with this loan here. And for that reason, the balabait can't back out of it. But of course, the kohen or the recipient of the matana can always back out of such an item. And the Gemara says, Nichashua balim, that if the balim give hope of receiving any produce from this field in that given year, then when the matanot or the produce does show up, he can't garner those matanot on behalf of his loan because he'd assume that they weren't going to be there. Pshita. That's obvious that if someone gives up hope of something, is mityayesh from it, that they no longer have rights to it. So lo tzricha da akun. That this is a case where it dried out at its period of time, where there is a chance that the produce will recover from this drying out, but it is unlikely to happen. Madutema, I would have thought possibly akanta miltahi, that this type of drying out is considered to be not full yeush because of that possibility. Kamash Malan, that we assume that if a person gives up hope at that time, they really are giving up full hope of receiving anything from this field. As Rashi explains over here, there are different stages of the drying out of the produce, that the produce can dry out lightly. And in that case, if it rains, if water is provided, then the produce will come back and be fine. So in that case, nobody has yeush, nobody gives up hope. There are other more extreme forms of drying out, by which if the water is brought within a short time period afterwards, then there's a likely recovery of the produce that's there. But if it's not brought in short order, then the produce, which is already wilting and dried out, will not recover. There is a threshold beyond which, if the produce dries out, then even if you provide water afterwards, the produce is lost. So the Gemara here is describing a scenario, as Rashi says over here, the stalks have already come out of the ground, and therefore there's a higher likelihood that once the stalks are out of the ground, that they can actually recover from the absence of water over that period of time from the drying out. So you'd have thought that it's a less likely outcome that you would lose the whole crop over here, because once the stalk is out, there is a good chance that it could recover. Nevertheless, we see once the Balim give up hope, that's it. And it's giving up hope without any reservations. And we consider it as if they have Yeush on the entire harvest here. Tanya, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Amaveh Ma'ot et HaKohen v'et HaLevi b'Beitin, Omeitu. Here's like the last piece of our Mishnah where the loan was created in Beitin. Then the individual can go ahead after the death of the party in which, with whom they have this agreement. They can continue to be mafrish alehem b'skat oto ashevet. They're allowed to then garnish the matanot for the repayment of the loan, because as if it belongs, or the loan belongs to the entire shevet of kuhuna or shevet Libyan. Betani b'beitin, and similarly, if he lends money to the poor person in Beitin, umeit, and then that individual passes away, mafrish alav b'cheskat aniye Yisrael. He's allowed to be mafrish, or continue to garnish the matanot aniyim, based on the chazakah of aniye Yisrael. And as Rashi over here points out, that the brito of desir segregated between these two items, because of the nature of these groups. Kehuna and Libya is a familial inheritance. And therefore, they're always yorshim to any party that is a Kohen or a Levi, because they always have relatives that are Kohanim and Levim. And therefore, when he lands in Beitin, he can continue to be Mafrish the Matanot based on the Shevet, because automatically there's someone who is Yoresh over here inheriting this individual who will be a Kohen or who will be a Levi. And so for that reason, he continues to take or garnish the matanot based on the shevet itself. On the other hand, for aniim, that is not necessarily true. Just because an individual is an ani doesn't mean that his yoshim are aniim. That is not something that is inherited. It's something particular to the individual. And for that reason, the way that it's worded in the Braita is that if he lends any b'beitin, it's b'chazkat aniye Yisrael. It's in the chazakah of all of Ani Yisrael, who are not necessarily his relatives, because, as Rashi points over here, Tehoyel b'takanat aniyim hu, nechaluhu l'chol Ani Yisrael, sheidat zu noheget b'Yisrael, kidei shimtzu malvim lehem k'shitztarchu. This is a takanah for the benefit of poor people in general, to create liquidity in the market by which people will lend them money, because they have ways of ensuring that they get paid back those loans that they make. And so for that reason, even though it's particular to this ani, and none of his yorshim have any connection to this loan, despite that fact, the chazal or Beit Din imposes the obligation of repayment on all the aniim, even though they might have no relationship or have nothing to do with this particular ani, because it's to the benefit of all aniim in general. As opposed to, again, by the case of the Kohen and Levi, where it says the Shevet, because there, the parties that inherit from this individual have the benefits of the Yerusha from this individual. They're part of that Shevet. And therefore, there's always a direct Yoresh, as Rashi points out, that will have, quote unquote, some obligation of repayment. And that's why you can garnish the matanot of the Shevet, because there's going to be someone there who technically is obligated to repay. And that's what we mentioned before, that there can be distinctions between an Ani and Kohen Levi in the Mishnah because of the nature of their differences with regards to inheritance. And therefore, some suggest that that part of our Mishnah that says, Tzarich Litol Rishut Me'a Yoshim, is only applicable by a Kohen and Levi where there are Yoshim, as opposed to Ani, where there's no automatic Yusha of the Aniyut. Over there, you can look at it one of two ways. There, even getting Rishut doesn't help, or maybe over there you don't need Rishut because of this takana, as Rashi says over here, of the obligation towards all of Ani Yisrael because of the benefit to all the parties here, independent of Yerusha. And within this breita that we continue, it says, Rav Chai Omer, Bechazkat Aniyei Olam, that they disagree as to which Aniyim are responsible for the repayment of this loan. You have the Tana Kama, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, who says that it's Bechazkat Aniyei Yisrael, and Rabbi Achai that says it's Bechazkat Aniyei Olam. Ma binayu, what's the nafkamina as to the wording of which Aniyim are responsible? So the Gemara says, Ike binayu Aniyei Kutim. It has to do, or the nafkamina between them has to do with the Aniyim of the Kutim. So if there are no Aniyei Yisrael in the city, but only Aniyei Kutim, then there will be a nafkamina between them. So the way that Rashi explains it over here, the Kutim Gerei Ametim, that Kutim are considered to be full-fledged converts. Ulatanakama Gerei Arayotim. On the other hand, for the Tanakama, they are considered to be converts out of fear, and not full-fledged converts or Yisraelim. And therefore, according to Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov, the Tanakama, they are Gerei Arayot, and they're not entitled necessarily to these Matanot, and therefore it's only Aniyei Yisrael. Whereas according to Rav Achai, they are considered to be Gerei Emet, and therefore they can be separated for, they can be held responsible for the repayment of these loans that were done on behalf of the Aniyei Yisrael. And as Rashi says over here, so if you're in a city that only has Aniyei Kutim, according to the Tanakama, he should not just separate out the Matanot on behalf of the Aniyim of that city, but rather for the Aniyim of the whole world or Aniyei Yisrael, wherever they're found. On the other hand, according to Rav Achai, you can even be mafrish for the Aniyei Kutim of that particular city. Now, as Tosafot points out, that Rashi's explanation in the end really has no nafkamina. His nafkamina is about the wording of how you're mafrish the matanot, or how it's structured the payment plan. But in the end, this individual can set up the program, either by saying that it has to do with the Aniyim of this city, or has to do with the Aniyei Yisrael, wherever they're found. And therefore, the Reed says that that's not the way to explain this. Ella, Omeri, Delotakino, Bechaskat, Aniyei Ayir. This whole program is only set up with the right to collect from the Aniyim of that local area, of that local city. And therefore, there is enough nafkamina between them when you only have Aniyei Kutim in this city. According to the Tanakama, then you cannot be mafrish based on that because the Aniyei Kutim do not qualify as Aniyim. And therefore, you cannot garnish the matanot based on the fact that there are Aniyei Kutim in this city. On the other hand, Rav Achai believes that the Aniyei Kutim are full-fledged Aniyim. And if they are the Aniyim that are found in the city, you can continue to garnish the matanot with the assumption or because of the Aniyim that are found in that city. And so that this structure can be put in place even if there are only Aniyei Kutim or if there only remain Aniyei Kutim in the city. So they see a real nafkamina that the whole program is only set up for local Aniyim, which would make sense because of the fact that they're the ones who have access to this produce and they're the most likely benefits or beneficiaries of this produce. And therefore, as we said in Rashi, if this takana is set up for the benefit of the Aniyim as a class as a whole, it would make sense that the class includes individuals who could be beneficiaries of such a program. And that would only be the local Aniyim. And that's how Tosfot explains it versus what Rashi seems to indicate here. It's a wording issue, not a nafkamina, whether you can create such a structure or not. Hey, Asher Hani, ain't mafrish alav. The Ani becomes wealthy, you can no longer be mafrish matanot based on that. V'zacha alav b'mashi b'yado. The loveh, the debtor over here, is then free and clear of repaying the loan. So the assumption is that the malveh, the creditor, will not come after the debtor at all, because he has a way to get repayment of his loan. But if the status of this individual changes, then that status change no longer grants him the right to garnish the matanot. And so because of that, he can not receive repayment of the loan. He can't go after the debtor because those are the terms of the loan. And he can't take matanot anymore because this individual is no longer entitled to matanot and aniyim because he became wealthy. Rabbanan, Maishna the mita da avud takanta, maishna the ashirut to lo avud takanta. Based on this, our Mishnah says that if the person passes away, that we have a way to deal with it, either through the Yorshim or through the mechanism of Beit Din. So the Rabbanan set up a mechanism to deal with the death of the individual, set up such a payment plan. But here, if the Ani becomes wealthy, there is no takana in place to protect the creditor. So when it says, mita shchicha, death is common, or in essence, inevitable. Ashirut lo shchicha. On the other hand, becoming wealthy is not inevitable, and is actually not common. And therefore, the Chachamim established takanot for items or situations that are common, but they did not set up takanot for things that are uncommon. Amar Rav Papa, Hainu Damrei Inshe, Chaver Chamit Asher. So that's what Rav Papa says, that the common pidgam, idiom that people say, is that if someone tells you your friend passed away, believe them. Itasher, that your friend became wealthy. Lotasher, don't believe them or do not take that as a given. Because the likelihood that someone passed away is, again, an inevitable occurrence and something that is very possible. And then that someone becomes wealthy is a less likely outcome. Meit tzarich litol reshut. Tanya, Rabbi Omer Yoshim Shershu. This only applies to Yoshim who inherited from the individual who had taken out this loan originally. Mar says, Umika Yoshim telo yarte. Since when do you have inheritors that don't inherit? Ela Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Sheyashu karka, lo sheyashu ksafim. That Rabbi means that these are individuals who inherited land from their father, whoever it was that gave them the inheritance, but not that they were Yoresh monies or mitaltalim. Because Rashi says over here, Sheshu karka shalehem mutala mitzvah lifruach of lataviyem. Because those individuals have an obligation to repay the loans of their father. Because there's a certain amount of encumbrance of the loan on the land of the individual. And therefore when they inherit karka, they also inherit the obligation of repayment. As to which part of the Mishnah this is going on, is a major machloket rishonim. Over here you can see the Balei HaTosafot says here, Aseifa Koi. This is going on the latter part of the Mishnah, the part where he did the loan in front of Beit Din. Im hilva b'fnei Beit Din ein tzarich litol reshut min ha-yoshim. That is only in the case where he inherits the karka, and that's the qualification that Rabbi makes over here. Aval ha-resha. But the earlier part that says, Meit tzarich litol reshut min ha-yoshim, lo matzi koi, that it's not speaking about. The kosher came in lo yashu should directly told reshut. Because if he didn't inherit karka, then certainly he has to ask permission. Meaning that if they inherit karka, he has to ask permission. Then certainly if he doesn't, then he'll also have to ask permission. And therefore it doesn't make sense to qualify that earlier case in the Mishnah. And therefore Tosafot says this whole issue of karka is relevant to this piece that deals with Beit Din. That doing it in front of the Beit Din creates a situation in which he doesn't have to get permission from the Yerushim. But Beit Din as a takana allows him to collect from the shevet as a whole or the class as a whole because of the takana to provide liquidity of loans to the market. And that is true only according to Tosafot if the inheritor here inherits land. Whereas the majority of Rishonim believe just the opposite of Tosafot, that the qualification of Rabbi here is on that middle piece of the Mishnah, the ratio of the Mishnah as Tosafot calls it, where he's asking permission from the Yorshim. And that is that he's only allowed to ask permission from the Yerushim to continue to collect when they have inherited land, because then the loan is quote-unquote still alive because of the encumbrance of the karka to the loan. On the other hand, if the individual passes away without any land, then based on the agreement that was set that the payment be made out of the matanot, the loan is terminated and there is no more repayment of the loan, and therefore the person can't go collect even if he gets permission from the Yerushim, because the obligation has disappeared. Therefore, according to those Rishonim, karka is essential for the continuation of the obligation to pay, and that is with regards to Yerushim. On the other hand, when it's done in Beit Din, Beit Din can overcome that deficit, because then Beit Din, because of their takana, assigns the obligation of repayment to the entire shevet or class in order to keep liquidity in the market. So it's a very fundamental machloket as to where this qualification of Rabbi applies, that it must be done out of the karka. Amar Rabbi Yonatan. Rabbi Yonatan says, Hiniach melo machat, gova melo machat. If he leaves a small tract of land, then the individual is only allowed to collect as repayment of the loan the amount of value of the land that was left behind. Melo kardom, gova melo kardom. If he leaves a larger tract of land, then he can collect a larger tract of money. And so basically, Rav Yonatan says that the repayment of the loan is subject to the value that was left behind by this individual. You can only collect matanot up to the value of karko that he left behind. On the other hand, Rav Yochanan Amar, afilu iniach melo machat gova melo kardom. Even if he leaves a pin's worth of land, he can collect pickaxes or hatchets worth of land. Ukumase de katina de abayi. Similar to the case of katina de abayi, which is a case in which the debtor left behind land that was not sufficient for collection of the loan. So the creditor went ahead and took the property as repayment of the loan, but couldn't get the full loan repaid because it was only worth half. The Yorshim came to him and paid him money to get the land back to free it from him. And then he went ahead and collected the land again afterwards and took it back for the remainder of the loan. And that worked over there because the encumbrance was on the land that is given to the Yorshim. And it doesn't matter how they get the land here, where they paid money to get the land back, he went ahead and collected again. Now, even though, as Tosfot points over there, in that case, if they specify when the land is given to him and then they repay it, that he does not have access to it, that they're repaying the loan and he cannot get the land again, they could stop that process of him coming back and grabbing the land back if they buy it back from him. Nevertheless, as Tosfot says over here, that would not work over here, that there's a takanat derabanan here in order to, again, help out the liquidity in the market, that we allow them to collect on a small parcel of land as much as the value of the loan that remains through the matanot in order to maintain liquidity in the market. Tanu Rabbanan, Yisrael shamar lelevi, maser yesh lecha biyadi, ein choshishim l'trumat maser shibo. If Yisrael says to a Levi, I have maser in my hand that is yours, you don't worry about the trumat maser in it. Kur, maser yesh lecha biyadi, he tells him the specified amount of maser that he has for the Levi, choshishim l'trumat maser bo. And then you do worry about the trumat maser that's in it. Remember that Maaser Rishon belongs to the Levi, but out of the Maaser Rishon, the Levi has to separate out 10% of that trumat maser and give it to the Kohen. So now the Gemara asks, Maika Amar, what is meant by this Braita? So Amar Abai, Abai gives an explanation, which is, Hachi Kamar, Yisrael shamar the Levi, maser yesh techa biyadi, v'helech tamav. And Yisrael says to the Levi, listen, you have maser that I have segregated out for matanot, and now I have to give to a Levi. Here, take the money. We don't have to worry about the fact that he made it into trumat maser somewhere else. I mean, now that he purchased the maser from the Levi, you don't have to worry about the fact that the Levi now turned around and used this maaser rishon to become trumat maser on his other maaser rishon that he has somewhere else. So if this Levi has tons of other maaser rishon and he has to segregate out trumat maser, some of his maaser rishon has to be used trumat maser. So he could make this maaser rishon that's being held by this balabait into trumat maser not only on itself, but on all of his maaser rishon. We don't worry about that. On the other hand, kor maaser yesh lecha biyadi behelech damav. Now then, if he says there's a certain or a fixed amount of maaser in my hand, and here's the money for it, and the Levi accepts the money. There we worry about the fact that he made it into Trumat Maser on something else, because he gave them the measurement, the fixed amount that was there. In the first instance, he doesn't know the quantity of Maser Rishon that is there. Since he doesn't know the exact quantity, he can't make it Trumat Maser, because he doesn't know how much is there in order to make it Trumat Maser on something else. But in the second instance, where he has the exact measurement of Maser Rishon that's there, he could use that. If he has 10 kur of Maaser Rishon somewhere else, he could use that kur of Maaser Rishon with this individual and make it into Trumat Maser. Now, the way Rashi explains it is that after the Yisrael receives money for it, doesn't worry about the fact that the Levi does this or changes it into Trumat Maser. That obviously raises serious issues, because after he sold the Maaser Rishon, how does he have a right then to change it into Trumat Maser? So Rashi explains that over here and says, so even though this transaction went down, since the Balabait never made any Mishicha on the Maaser Rishon, the Levi can back out of it. And even though it's in the possession of the Israel right now, the fact that he paid for it is not an automatic kinyan. The Eimat Kanyo, Hai Levi, to the Kani Israel, Bekabalat Mot. Because when did the Levi take possession of the Maaser Rishon, that the money is given to him would then transfer the ownership back to the Israel. Since it never left the possession of the Israel, the payment of money does not generate a kinyan over here. And for that reason, Rashi says that even though the Yisrael has already paid for it, the Levi, in a sense, could back out of it and change it into Trumat Maser. Tosafot is bothered by this, and he says, how could it be that after he sold it, that he could back out of this if it's in the possession of the Yisrael? And therefore, Tosafot changes the case, even though it's not written this way, and the Gemara doesn't sound like this way from the words, to solve the problem by saying, Yishlamar Deshema So Kodem Kabbalat Adamim Kamar. Before he took receipt of the money, maybe he changed it to Trumat Maser, which again, is not so simple that how is he selling something once he already made it into Trumat Maser? In either case, he's not doing something that is so straightforward, and that's going to be the next question of the Gemara. Was other Rishonim solve the problem that Rashi raises by saying that it's a case where the Maaser Rishon is not in the possession of this Balabait, but then you have the question of how can the Levi then make that into Trumat Maser if it never came into his possession? The answer is this is a case of Makirei Kehuna or Makirei Leviyah, where the individual was assumed to be the beneficiary, the recipient of this gift. The Gemara says about the suggestion of the explanation of Vayi, Altu Berishia Skinon, are we dealing with Shreim over here, Deshakli Dami, Umishavalei Trumat Maser, that they take payment of the item and then they change it into Trumat Maser? So according to Rashi and the other Rishonim, we take this literally. Do they take payment and then afterwards he backs out of it and changes it into Trumat Maser? Or according to Tosafot, the question is, he makes the Trumat Maser and then sells it as Maaser Rishon? Are we dealing with the Shame? El Amar of Misharshia, Breid Ravidi, this is the explanation. Hachi Kamar, Yisrael Shamar Ben Levi, Maser Le'avicha B'yadi, Helach Damav. And Yisrael who says to Ben Levi that I have Maser of your father's in my hand, here, take payment for it. In Choshishim Shema So Aviv Trumat Maser Al Makom Acher. We don't worry about the fact that the father in the interim made this into Trumat Maser for something else, and he can purchase this Maaser Rishon from the Levi with the assumption that it's still Maaser Rishon. On the other hand, Kur Maser LaAvicha B'Yodi, if I have specifies a certain quantity of Maaser Rishon that I have that belong to your father in my hand, Pehelech Damav, and here's the money, Choshishim Shema So Aviv Trumat Maser Al Makom Acher. Then we worry about the fact that this father, at some point, made this Maaser Rishon into Trumat Maser, another produce that he had. Now the Gemara asks on this explanation, since when are Chavirim suspected of segregating out or segregating Trumot from something that is not adjacent, something that is not in front of them? And now the question here of the obligation to separate Minam Mukaf, Rashi over here says, that the obligation is Shema Utosha Ina Bein Bimasa Asui, that there is a restriction against taking off Trumat Maser or Truma or even Maaser Rishon without the produce being in front of you, because we are afraid that the possibility that whatever you're trying to separate or segregate to or from doesn't exist anymore, and therefore we want it in front of you. So therefore, according to Rashi, it is not exactly that it has to be adjacent or right next to each other, but rather, simply, it has to be visible to you or known to you that the produce still exists. And because that would not be the case over here, because it was in the possession of the Balabayit, why would you assume that this Levi's father would have made this into Trumat Maser? On the other hand, as Tosafot points out over here, that he thinks that that's not the case, the reason of Rashi is incorrect, but rather it's a Gzeret HaKatuv, that one must take Min HaMukaf, which comes out of the pasuk of Varemotem Mimenu. That Mimenu means from it, something that is adjacent, or from the item itself, it must be taken out. And that demand is whether you can see it or not see it, it literally has to be physically adjacent in order to separate it out. Here, Tosafot goes into the discussion about Trumat Maser and the obligation Mina Mukaf. Because this din Mina Mukaf applies to Truma, the question is, what is its application with regards to Trumat Maser? And over here, the Tosafot makes the suggestion, Ve'esh lomar, midirabanan, af truat maser bayi mukaf. That, mina derabanan, this din of mukaf applies to trumat maser. And that is what is being spoken about here in the Gemara. Not an obligation midiraita, but rather an obligation midirabanan. And as Tosafot points out, there's an explicit mishnah in Bikurim that suggests that trumat maser does not require mina mukaf. So their answer is that it is a din derabanan. Other Rishonim suggest that there is no Dina Mukaf by Trumat Maser Migzerat HaKatuv, which is applicable by Truma, but over here they're Choshesh for what Rashi says over here, that if it's not in front of him, he can't be mafrish because of the possibility that it's not there anymore, or that he would not know the exact amount to take off, and so on and so forth. That this is really what Rashi suggests over here, because there is no obligation by Trumat Maser. Others suggest that there's no obligation of min mukaf min Trumat Maser, but Chavirim in general were mafrish min mukaf, even by Trumat Maser, despite the fact that there was no obligation to do so. And her assumption is over here that the produce was given to Chaver, as Tosfot points out, that you're only allowed to give Maser and Trumot to Chavirim. And therefore, our assumption is here that we're talking about Chavirim, and he would not have been mafrish shalom min mukaf. El Amar Ravashi, Ravashi comes up with the final explanation of this braita. Hachin Kamar, Ben Israel, a child of Israel, Shamar Levi, Kach Amar Li Abba. This is what my father told me, Maser Lecha Biyodi. You have Maser in my hands. Oh, Maser Le'avicha Biyodi. Or he tells him that my father told me that your father has Maser in my hand. Choshishim L'Trumat Maser Shibo. There, we worry about the Trumat Maser in it. Kevin de Lokaitz. Because it's not a fixed amount, the balabait would not have fixed it. Kur maser lecha biyodi. If he says, my father told me that you have a kur with a maser in my hands, or kur maser avicha biyodi, or there was a kur worth of maser that your father has, that's what my father told me. Ein choshishim l'trumat maser. There we do not worry about trumat maser shibo. Came into kites, since it's a fixed amount, tukune tukane balabait. Then the balabait went ahead and fixed it. So here, the chashash is whether the balabait, who has the maaser rishon over here, segregated out the trumat maser that was in it. Now, the Gemara's next question is going to be, what right does the balabait have to do that? Because maaser rishon belongs to the Levi, and the obligation to separate trumat maser is on the Levi, to give it to the Kohen, not on the balabait. But right now, the Gemara's assumption is that the balabait would take care of it if he knew how much trumat maser to take off. So in a case where there's a fixed amount of maser that he knows about, then we assume that he wouldn't let it linger without having the trumat maser segregated from it, and therefore he took it off in that case. On the other hand, if it was an amount that was not fixed, and therefore he didn't know how much trumat maser to take off, because when he tells it over, he just says, there is maser here, then we don't assume that he separated out the trumat maser, and therefore when the maser rishon now is given or separated out, we will need to take off Trumat Maser, because we assume that the balabait did not do it in this case. And even though now, the way that Ravashi is explaining it, the word Choshishim turns out to be the opposite way of the Braita, you'd have to explain it somewhere along the lines of Choshishim means in the Braita, Ein Choshishim that he took off Trumat Maser. That means that we are Choshesh for the fact that there is Trumat Maser left. And you have to explain it something like that in order to have it fit with the language of the Braita. And now the Gemara asks the obvious question, since when does the balabait have a right to take off trumat maaser? The Gemara says in, yes, he does have a right to do that, and that's based on Abelazar ben Gamlohi. Abelazar ben Gamlo, who is his cameo appearance in Shas, which is only regards to this halacha that we see him in Shas, in a number of places, based on the braita that we have here. The Tanya, Abelazar ben Gamlo omer, nechshav lechem trumatchem. Kigagan min hagorim. So that the truma here is speaking about trumat maaser, and that trumat maaser will be considered like dagan min hagorim, similar to truma gdola. And therefore, he sees here b'shtei trumot hakatuv midaber. The pasuk is speaking about two trumot. That is achat truma gdola and achat trumat maaser. Now again, in reality, there's only one truma being spoken about here, which is the trumat maaser. But the fact that the Torah connects the Trumat Maser and says it has the same status as the Trumat Gdola creates a hekesh between the two items. And therefore, Kishem Shetrumat Gdola Nitelet Be'omet Ummachshava, just like Trumat Gdola can be separated by estimation and through thought, Kach Trumat Maser Nitelet Be'omet Ummachshava. So too, Trumat Maser can be taken off by estimation and by thought. Ukishem Shesh Lo Rishut the Balabait Litrom Trumat Gdola. And just like the balabait has the right to separate out trumat gdola, or in essence, it's his obligation to separate out the trumat gdola, kach yesh lo reshut the balabait litrom trumat maser. So too, the balabait has a right to separate out the trumat maser from the maser rishon. That is the sheet of Elazar ben Gamlo. And then this answer of the Gemara leads to much discussion amongst the rishonim, which we will deal with here one by one. The first of which is, the Gemara before says that the Braita differentiates between whether there's a fixed amount or not a fixed amount of Maaser Rishon here. So Tosfot answers that question by saying that even though Elazar ben Gamla allows you to do a Be'omed in estimation, and therefore even if you didn't know the exact amount of the Maaser Rishon, he could still separate out the Trumat Maaser. Nevertheless, the Tosfot says over here, V'yesh lomar deinu torim omed, that a person wouldn't do this with something that doesn't belong to him. Here where the Baal HaBayit is acting on behalf of the Levi and the Kohen in a sense, by taking the Trumat Maaser off of the Levi's Maaser Rishon, he won't do it by estimation because he could cause losses for the Levi and the Kohen over here. Never only does it if he knows the exact amount. He won't do it if he's uncertain as to the amount that's there. The second thing Tosfot points out is just because the Baal HaBayit has permission to do this, how can we assume that he did do it? And that, he says, is based on a principle in general that we have by Chaverim, which is that they don't like to leave around produce for a long period of time that is not mitukan, which is not settled, because they have a fear that people are going to utilize it or eat it, and they don't want that to be a risk that is on their shoulders. And therefore, if something stays with them for a duration, they will for sure ensure that all the matanot are given. And therefore, over here, where it's clear that this Maaser Rishon stayed with them for a period of time, then for certain he would have separated out the Trumat Maaser, even though he is not obligated to do. Since he had the permission to do it, he for sure did it. Now, as Tosfot points out over here, this limud of Baba Elazar ben Gamla is not so simple, because there's a difference between Trumat Gdola and Trumat Maaser. Trumat Gdola, kita achat poteret etekri. There is no fixed amount of Trumat that you need to give. Any minimum amount will discharge your obligation in regards to Trumat. And therefore it makes sense that one would take it mi-omed, would take it by estimation, because even if the person doesn't get the exact amount, he still discharges obligation with regards to Trumat Gdola. But by Trumat Maaser, where there's an exact definition of the amount that one must give, which is Trumat Maaser, Maaser mina Maaser, 1/10 of the tenth that he's given, or 10% of the Maaser Rishon, how could Abba Elazar ben Gamla suggest that you can do it mi-omed? And it's clear that the Chachamim disagree with Abba Elazar ben Gamla, who say that you can do Truma, or you do Truma Be'omet, but that's not true by Trumat Maaser. Well, you need to do it by exact measurement, because otherwise you won't get to the 10% of the 10% that you're supposed to give. But we still have to explain the Shita of Abba Elazar ben Gamla. So Tosafot over here suggests that, according to Abba Elazar ben Gamla, you cannot go under the shear of 10%. The reason for demanding that a person give Trumat Maaser Be'omet is because the person is going to be fearful of doing the wrong thing, which is that if he gives less than 10%, he did not discharge his obligation. But if we tell him to give exactly 10%, that's what he'll do. He'll give exactly the 10%. Other than if we tell him you cannot be below 10%, but you have to give it through estimation, then what he's going to end up doing is overestimating the amount to ensure that he doesn't miss that threshold of 10%. And that's why the Torah demands that he gives the Trumat Maaser in that manner, because that will turn out that he will actually give in a more generous manner to avoid going below the threshold of 10%. Then Tosafot discusses the issue that we have from the Mishnayot and Avot and other places, that a person who is marbe b'masrotav, person who gives more than they should in masrot, masrotav mekulkalim, he actually ends up with a problem here, because he's mafrish beyond the limits that were given in the Torah, and therefore what he's giving is not really maaser, and it has all sorts of complications that come with it. And he says, how does Abba Elazar ben Gamla deal with this? Which leads Tosafot to discuss different possibilities within the position of Abba Elazar ben Gamla as to what he thinks the obligation to give Bina Omed is by Trumat Maaser. Does he believe similar to Trumat Gdola, where it's an obligation to give Bina Omed? Similar, he believes, by Trumat Maaser, that he must give it Bina Omed. And then he has to reconcile with the issue of Amar Beb and Masrutav, whether he doesn't hold of that, or whether he can deal with it in a different manner, or does he believe that by Trumat Gdola there's an obligation to give Be'omet, by Trumat Maaser there's only a mitzvah, that it is a better way to do it, but it's not obligatory to give it in that manner, or the third possibility, which is that not only is it not an obligation and not a mitzvah, but it's a reshut. He has an option to do it that way, or the better way to do it is through measurement. But Abba Elazar ben Gamla is saying that you have permission to do it be'omed by Trumat Maaser, and it's a dispensation rather than an obligation or a mitzvah to do it be'omed. And Tosafot brings all these different possibilities in explaining this position of Abalazar ben Gamlo. And then similarly, whatever you think the position of Abalazar ben Gamlo is, then you would have to explain that what exactly the position of the Chachamim who argue on him is. So depending on what Abalazar ben Gamlo thinks, that will also have impact or influence what we think the machloket between him and the Chachamim is, and as to what exactly their opinion is. The other thing Tosafot discusses over here is the word machshava, which Rashi over here interprets that machshava means that you do not have to physically separate out the trumot and masrot over here, but if you simply think in your mind that one section will be truma in the future, or one section will be maaser rishon or truma maaser in the future, then you can eat it even though you have not physically separated out that item. And as Rashi says over here, machshava notenena b'tzadzeh, the same truma, vochel b'tzadzeh, afo pish lo hifrish. You can do this without actually being mafrish. Machshava suffices in this case. And that, as Rashi points out, is born out of the word, v'nechshav lachem, trumotchem, that word nechshav is used to teach us both of these items. Nechshav is to teach us that through machshava you can do the hafrasha. And number two is that it can be done by omed, that it can be done by estimation, and both of those items are learned out of the word v'nechshav. On the other hand, the Meiri suggests over here that va'omed u'machshava is really a duplication of the same thing. The way that you do it va'omed is by machshava. That machshava is just telling us that the estimation is done as mind, and therefore there's only one halacha that's taught here, according to Abalazar ben Gamlo, which is that you can do this va'omed through estimation, not that you can separate or segregate out through machshava. Tosafot over here points out that Rashi and other places in Shas says that the machshava over here means dibor, that he actually articulates it. He doesn't physically separate it, but he articulates it. But he says that he thinks Rashi's interpretation over here, which means that simply it's in his mind and he doesn't even articulate it, is the proper explanation. But then he goes on to explain that the machloket here between the Chachamim and Abalazar ben Gamlo is only with reference to the Ba'omed part of this limud, that you do the Truman Maser in estimation. But by the machshava aspect of it, the Chachamim agreed to Abalazar ben Gamlo, and that by Trumat Maser and Trumat Gdola, then one can separate it out through Machshava, and the Chachamim agreed to this limit or this Hekesh that comes out of Nechshav of Abalazar ben Gamlo. Although most of the Rishonim argue on Tosafot and say that the Chachamim disagree with this position of Abalazar ben Gamlo, which is also evidenced by Tosafot's Shita back on a Chavhei Amudbet and his explanation of the word Mechal over there, he made it clear that he disagreed with Rashi with regards to the segregation of Maaser Sheni, that it couldn't be done simply through Machshava, but it had to be done through physical separation. And therefore, the majority of the Rishonim believe that the Chachamim disagree with this point as well, and that they believe you need physical separation of the produce, and Machshava is not sufficient in terms of separation over here. Okay, we're going to stop here by the Mishnah on the top of Lamed Aleph, Amud Aleph.